Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and okay, all you single WNYC listeners, admit it, you don't really care if she likes candlelit dinners or if he takes long walks on the beach. What really matters is, can you talk to this person? Are they as informed and curious as you are? Do they keep up with current events? That's why we're hosting the first ever WNYC Singles event. I will be there moderating a news quiz. That will be Tuesday, June 6th at SOB's, and you can get tickets on the events page at WNYC.org, the first ever WNYC singles event. Now, this is a time when the business of putting words on paper is starting to look quaint, if not foolhardy, but perhaps reports of the industry's death are a bit exaggerated. The four young founders of the literary journal N Plus One hope so anyway, inspired by the tales of the halcyon days for New York intellectuals, that's intellectuals with a capital I, especially the 50s of partisan review, and disturbed by the youth culture they see around them, they ended their first issue with the words, "No, enough." The fourth issue has just been published, and tomorrow night they'll hold a seminar at the Kitchen on the state of American writing. How's that for serious? I'm joined in the studio by two of the journal's founding editors, Keith Gessen and Mark Greif. Keith's work has appeared beyond his own journal in Dissent, The Nation, New York, The New Yorker, and the New York Review of Books. He's also translated the book, Voices from Chernobyl, which won the National Book Critics Circle Award for nonfiction last year. Mark Greif's essay, Against Exercise, is in the first issue of N Plus One, was included in the Best American Essays anthology in 2005. Welcome, both of you, to WNYC. Hi.
Thanks very much. Hi.
So let me start with the name of your journal, N Plus One. What does it mean? Why did you pick a mathematical next number reference for a literary journal title?
Well, we certainly remembered it from math class in high school, and I hope there are no math teachers listening today, because we just wanted to evoke something, a kind of continuing series that doesn't end. When we were in college and growing up, I at least was sort of haunted by the end of history thesis that you used to hear from Francis Fukuyama.
Right at the end of the Cold War.
Right, as if everything had come to an end and liberal capitalism was just going to spread over the globe and no one would have to make decisions anymore and the nothing new would reign. And I guess the idea of N plus one is that there's always something new coming and we hope to provide it.
And we're always trying to get more math into the magazine.
More math into our innumerate literary society. So that's, I mean, but that's a political statement that you made about things coming after the end of history. What does it mean in terms of literature?
Well, you know, this is actually the peculiarity of N plus one, that we started it 2 years ago in 2004, but really committed to doing it at the end of 2003, in part because of the Iraq War and the debate over the Iraq War. There seemed to be a million places where you could respond, react, say, I'm against this, I'm against that, but not so many places where you could go to the root of problems. And of course, our perversity was to say we face a political problem, an era of urgency, and what we're going to do is start a literary magazine.
So the symposium you're holding tomorrow night at the Kitchen, I see from one of the essays in the new issue that Partisan Review held one on the same topic, the state of American writing in 1948. What was going on that inspired that particular symposium, and what was the verdict in 1948?
Oh, me again, yeah, as the historian of N plus one. You know, it was the case that all of the great intellectual magazines in American life, they did these things kind of ad nauseum to the point where people would get frustrated. They would do big temperature takings of the culture, big symposia in Partisan Review and Commentary through the 60s, and then they seemed to stop. And I feel like from this symposium and also from, you know, the New York Times this week has done a big poll about what was the best novel of the past 25 years, I think we're at a moment of stock-taking again and of a kind of reassessment of what does the novel do, what does literature do, and how does it move the culture forward.
And between 1948 and now came the 60s and Watergate and postmodernism, the idea of putting truth in quotation marks and love in quotation marks and opening the canon to other voices and the media to other voices. Did that cause a big change to American writing?
Certainly. I mean, I think one of the things that's happened is there's been a fracturing of the consensus. If you read the 48 symposium, they all sound very much alike. They all have a very clear sense of living in a particular historical epoch, which they define as an epoch of anxiety, the beginning of the Cold War. Whereas in our symposium, all the contributors have very different points of view. And I've found, for example, that I agree with maybe two of them out of nine. It's very, very confusing for the people who've been reading it because they think that we agree with all of them. And,
like on what kinds of major questions?
There's an essay against the short story, which I am a writer of short stories. So the writer of that essay, Elif Batuman, thinks that the short story has lived out its historical usefulness and can no longer really be written, which not quite true.
Yeah. Well, just out of intellectual curiosity, because I haven't read that essay, why would somebody argue that just to write against even the writing of a short story? In fact, with today's attention spans, I would think that a short story might be particularly useful.
There's two parts to the argument. I think the first part is simply that there's no market for the short story, and so it's being propagated by workshops, the MFA programs, which really encourage the writing of short stories because they're easy to talk about in workshop, and then by the magazines, which only have room for short stories. And otherwise, there's not really people don't want books of short stories, we're told.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, 93.9 and AM 820, as we talk with Keith Gessen and Mark Reif, founding editors with Marco Roth and Benjamin Kunkel of N Plus One, a literary and political journal. So calling all New York intellectuals with capital or small I's, do you read contemporary, or for that matter, in quotation marks, do you read contemporary American novels and short stories anymore? Are our lives significant enough compared with those of past generations to immortalize in novels? Call us at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. By the way, how have you answered your critics that N Plus One is, in fact, the voices of four white male Ivy League-educated young men?
Well, guilty as charged on the factual point, I suppose. Beyond that, you know, when we started this thing, it was clear to us we were all writing book reviews and sort of targeted political things. There were various things that it was very easy to say, which we were allowed to say, but no place that we could just go to the bottom of matters, try to write about intractable things. My essay in this new issue that's come out is called Afternoon of the Sex Children. I feel like the sex children have been waiting for their moment to be truly taken on in American culture, and at last this is a place to do it.
And the sex children are?
I feel like everybody knows who the sex children are. The sex children are these semi-mythical, semi-real figures in the culture. They're those kids who go on spring break, you know, and Britney Spears and her epigones. These children who supposedly are having fantastic lives of sexual freedom and license. And what that essay, Afternoon of the Sex Children, is about: why do we find those kids so fascinating? Why do we imagine their lives are better? And why is there this desire directed at them? And then at the same time, of course, in America, the absolute most evil person, the kind of worst figure we can imagine, is the pedophile, the person who takes that kind of desire for children either, you know, to too young an age or too intensely. And so this is the kind of thing that N Plus One can do, which I think is important for the medium. We have more space as opposed to a blog or something quick and editorial to say, look, there's some kind of paradox here, something that makes no sense. And can we figure out how it works?
And I also think that one of the things that it would be disingenuous to sit here and pretend like there aren't a lot of good magazines doing literary criticism and a lot political writing that's also literary. But one of the things that we haven't been able to talk about in these other magazines that we write for is the sort of the inheritance from the 60s and the sexual liberation and the way that it would seem that the sexual liberation of the 60s would have caused us to be more casual and less worried about sex, whereas in fact it seems like it's just entered the culture at every level. And this is something that we need to deal with very seriously.
You've kind of played up your differences with the Eggersards, fans of Dave Eggers, who wrote a heartbreaking work of staggering genius and went on to found three journals, Might, McSweeney's, and Believer. Can you frame that difference for us, for people who might know those journals? How different are your sensibilities? What's the issue here? Whichever of you wants it.
I think we're different sort of all the way down the line. One of the important things in terms of, for example, this Symposium on American Literature is the way that I think they have done a lot of good things, but they want to protect literature. They feel literature is should be a sort of an ecosphere that's separated from the world, whereas all of the fiction that we publish and all the fiction that we're interested in is very political and is engaging contemporary society. And that's something that I think everybody who's written an N+1 feels very strongly about, the direct engagement of literature with life. So that's one of them.
Yeah, and it should be said, you know, people do wind up thinking in pairs, which is part of the reason that this McSweeney's N+1 thing has continued. You know, you have the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, you have vanilla and chocolate, and so somehow we've wound up in this position of being linked in a pair.
And isn't that part of the fun of declaring yourselves New York intellectuals, feuding with other intellectuals?
Absolutely, absolutely.
If you like, I'll play Dick Cavett to your Mary McCarthy, and you can try to get them to sue you for libel.
That we can't afford, unfortunately.
Maybe not. But so on the larger question that you're framing for this symposium at the Kitchen tomorrow night, the state of American writing, where do you start? Or maybe I should ask you a few particular questions on your own takes on these. Number one, does Oprah figure into your calculations?
Well, it turns out Oprah is one of the kind of central characters that people keep writing about. I happen to like Oprah a great deal, and I even like the Oprah book club.
She's like the Napoleon of contemporary.
She just marches. Yes. She starts in France, and she marches through Europe. She's incredible. And she takes books with her all the way, you know, the Oprah book club choices. But it became very clear that people in publishing only think about Oprah. And when we have actually a great essay by an editor, Gerald Howard, and I kept talking to him as he was writing and rewriting his essay, and I said, why do you care so much about Oprah? And it just turns out that publishing has been transformed by the fact that a kind of lottery has been instituted. You know, it used to be publishers would work and they would draw a little paycheck, and now there's like a Powerball. They could just have this one book, if they chose the right one, that would win the entire jackpot and sell millions of copies. And it does seem to have transformed publishing.
And during the recent James Frey debacle, when he was on Oprah, the people in publishing houses gathered and watched this on television live as if it were this really horrible disaster.
Yeah, about making stuff up in his memoir, in a book.
Well, yes. But the idea that Oprah once again would cancel her engagement with contemporary books and go back to reading Anna Karenina. Yes, that would really be the end of everything.
Elie Wiesel. So what about this issue of postmodernism? Are you trying to move beyond postmodernism in a sense? And if so, what are you trying to leave behind?
Well, I feel it's very important to say that we are great fans of postmodernism.
Yes.
Of the youth culture and of sexual liberation.
Mm-hmm.
And if anything, we go too far. We believe sexual liberation should have been carried all the way and the family destroyed and civilization started on a new foundation.
No, wait, that's a very big thing to say as a clause in a complex sentence. Is that really what you feel?
At 10:54.
A little bit, yeah. And this is how a lot of those N+1 essays work, I have to say. You know, you get to the end of the sentence and you're like, did he just say, civilization should be brought down and started on a new foundation? I think he might have said that.
Yeah. So you think what? We should not have any nuclear families? Is there a better way to raise children? Or where are you going with that?
Well, I'm not going to argue immediately for a Spartan system where children are taken away from their parents and, taught the warriorly arts. But I do think that it's our sense that things like sexual liberation and the triumphs of the 60s were captured by commerce. And so there was a moment of real excitement and openness, I think, when we read back in history and intellectual life, a moment of feminism, a moment of liberation at the end of the 60s, in which people said, we've been tyrannized over by all kinds of people who are persecuting us for just doing what we would do naturally, right? For having sexual freedom and the rest. Now it seems like we live at a moment where you go and watch your television, and there's a different kind of persecution, one that says, if you don't display your sexuality, if it's not the fundamental part of your life, or your identity isn't the fundamental part of your life, if you want a different kind of freedom, we'll persecute you for that. So, the project of liberation is still central to N+1. And postmodern liberation.
And in the latest issue of N+1, you call for redistribution of wealth, all income over $100,000 to be taxed.
That's true.
Keith, we're gonna run out of time soon. Mm-hmm. The new issue includes several essays on the topic of the state of American writing. Yours is about money and writing. So what does a writer have to do to survive in today's economy other than start your own literary journal?
Well, that would be a way of not surviving.
I guess.
I think a writer has to decide that he or she is not going to make any money pretty much for the rest of their lives. And once you've accepted that, then you're okay.
Then you're free to write the truth?
Yeah. Yes.
Absolutely.
And face the consequences. But I think the what's happened, you know, writers have always had to make money and they've always starved or not. But it seems like writers more and more have accepted the values of this system of handing out large cash prizes to certain writers and trying to compete in this system. And that's not why we started writing.
But then why a literary journal? Why pay for printing and kill all those trees, you know, when you could start a website or a blog and maybe, like my previous guests, reach a million viewers a day if you write some things that become viral?
Well, it's true that the ghosts of those trees we're killing have been haunting us. You know, in fact, we have a part called the intellectual situation in every issue that opens it. And this issue opens with a whole thing about global warming. Why a literary magazine? Because it's long, because it's slow, and the blogs, I think, are only able to react to events and to get upset about things.
And you'd be surprised at how cheap it is to actually print something.
Funny that the trees was not the first area which I expected you to react to that question. But talk more about the blogs. Do you think blogs can only really react? They can't generate?
They could. They haven't. Yeah. We spend a lot of time reading blogs that comment on us, and it seems like the blog encourages a sort of attitudinizing, and it discourages a sort of long, thoughtful presentation of the best self, which is what we're trying to do in print.
Certainly in the political sense, and yeah. Mark, I guess you're the more political guest, there's, or at least overtly in the stuff of yours that we've seen, and we just have about 45 seconds left, but our previous two guests who founded DailyCoast.com and MyDD.com, they would say they're not just reacting, they're, you know, trying to set the agenda to reform the Democratic Party. Maybe something like that could be done with literature.
Well, absolutely. You know, and I listened to the show last week with Michael Tomasky, a man I admire very much. And he says that new ideas, big ideas, have to come out. And I guess what we believe is that those ideas are not just going to come from people sitting around and saying, we need to reread Thomas Hobbes or we need to go back to Hamilton. It's going to come from the literary world, from the art world, and from a different kind of intellectual world. And that's what we're trying to do.
All right. And I didn't even get to ask Mark about his essay, Against Exercise. They're against the short story. Some of the people in N+1, Against Exercise, Against the Family. Mark Reif's essay, Against Exercise, in the first issue of N+1, was included in the Best American Essays Anthology of 2005. Keith Greif has been published in New York, The New Yorker, The New York Review of Books, even things with Keith Gessen, I'm sorry. And they have founded the journal N+1. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.